Making contact.
I'm Salima Hamarani, and this is Making Contact. As a journalist, I often interview people about their jobs, the moral side of their jobs, the ethical impact of what they do. So, for example, should app designers purposely make their products addictive? Should airline workers support the Muslim ban or protest it? These questions are really about a code of ethics or the principles behind your work. Some variation of the do no harm idea. But what about my job as a journalist?
All work, all journalistic work is biased in some way. What if we claimed our subjectivity and just kind of said, a lot of things are a matter of perspective. And from this perspective, we're trying to seek out the facts with evidence to the best of our ability.
Today, we're going to think about seeking truth and the concept of journalistic objectivity, a pillar of traditional journalism. Can a journalist, a human being with experiences and thoughts, ever simply be a neutral observer? Well, according to Lewis Wallace,
objectivity is the ideology of the status quo. What you call objectivity is actually just white, male, cisgender subjectivity. You know, it's just the status quo. There is no neutrality.
Okay, so for journalists listening to this episode, what we're about to hear might make you feel kind of uncomfortable. Because for many of us, the idea that objectivity isn't real hits at the core of the work that we do. And then there are journalists such as Lewis Wallace. Today, we're going to hear his story of how he came to question the idea of so-called truth in his work, and not just what the truth is, but also who it affects, and what gets ignored when we want to stay objective, even when there's a lot at stake. Here's Stephanie Lepp from the podcast Reckonings, interviewing Lewis Wallace.
I had been working as a barista during the day and doing this community organizing stuff in the afternoons and at night and in all of my spare time. And I was really exhausted from that combination of work and a little bit creatively frustrated. And at some point I was just up in the middle of the night kind of stressing about my life and trying to figure out, like, how can I get to be on the radio? I came across the Pritzker Fellowship, which was a fellowship specifically designed for people who live in Chicago, who do community organizing work, who want to learn how to be on the radio. And I made an audio piece for my application. That was my first kind of audio feature about my experience using my voice as a transgender person and how I imagined myself relating to that when I became a radio star.
That's Lewis Wallace, and he kind of did become a radio star. He got that Pritzker Fellowship and joined WBEZ in Chicago.
I was a really avid radio listener, so like everybody at WBEZ was kind of a celebrity to me. You know, the morning host, the afternoon host, all the reporters. Ira Glass wasn't on site at the time, but Melba Lara, the All Things Considered host, I was like a huge fan of.
After a couple stints in local radio, Lewis made the leap into national radio at Marketplace, based in New York City. Half the time he was in the newsroom, writing scripts and filing stories and doing the Marketplace Morning Report live with David Brancaccio, which meant speaking to up to 12 million people, which was his happy place. The other half the time, Lewis was traveling all over the country and talking to all kinds of people, which was his other happy place.
For Marketplace, I went to Detroit to do a series of stories about people who were being victimized by this often predatory form of lending called land contracts, which is like an unregulated way of making a home loan to a low-income person.
One victim of this scam was a man named Eddie Cave, who Lewis visited in his home in Detroit.
So Eddie had paid thousands of dollars out of pocket for a house that had no running water, no electricity, no heating or cooling. And he was quite severely disabled and in a wheelchair. And so he was living in what people might call, you know, third world conditions. He was drinking water from like gallon bottles, cooking on a propane gas stove inside, plugging in his electric wheelchair from like a generator outlet out in the back, and taking crutches up the stairs to sleep. And then he was going to be evicted, and the person who'd quote unquote sold him this house was trying to take the house back from him. So it was just like the worst like housing situation imaginable. And he was this lovely man who, you know, of course he'd been through all this stuff in his life, and we really connected and we had a beautiful conversation, and he talked to me a lot about the house and the way that he was getting screwed over in this land contract, but also just about himself. He was a DJ and he loved to throw parties, and he wanted to be a writer and a journalist and like report on what was going on in the community. And of course I was really supportive of that. And at some point Eddie just starts crying. I mean, crying into the microphone as he's talking to me, talking about how once he gets out from under this financial situation that he's in, he just can't wait to get back to being a DJ and doing music stuff. And then I left and went to the airport and filed my story, right? And there's this thing that happens when you sort of take a story like that from somebody where, like, you bring it to an editor and it's like, oh, this is good stuff. And there's something just so unsettling about that, you know, like connecting what I felt like was really deeply with somebody, but then knowing that, like, I'm basically here to take your story and like walk away with it and never come back. And you might never even hear this story, and the story might not help you at all. Who does this dynamic really serve? Going into a place like Detroit and talking to people who had just really been screwed over and asking them to share these like really horrible stories about things that had happened to them and really vulnerable stories, and then turning that into a feature for Marketplace, where the predominant audience is like a wealthy white audience. And I was never sure whether that kind of reporting makes a real difference in that community. I think there's sort of a trickle-down theory that's like, these people over here, you know, with more education, access, and privilege are going to learn about this injustice and then they're going to do something about it. But you're still left with the question of like, what if they don't? Have I just extracted this story from this one group of people to like feed to this other group of people, maybe almost as a form of entertainment? Or just to benefit myself and make my career go well? I tried to get Marketplace to send me to cover the Women's March in New York or DC, and they didn't want to send me. So that was fine. I was like, I'm going to go anyway and just make a recording for my own project. And of course, the Women's March in DC was huge. I mean, the whole city was shut down and there were so many people that there was no march, because there was no room in the streets for the people to march through. Like, the entire route of the march was already full of people before the march started. There was this like funky dynamic in DC too, because the inauguration had been the previous day and it emerged that there had been like a lot more people at the big protest on Saturday than there had at the inauguration on Friday. But I get back to work on Monday morning and they're replaying what happened on TV on Sunday, which was that Trump's, what was she, spokesperson at the time, Kellyanne Conway, had gone on morning TV on Sunday morning and kind of drilled down on this claim that there had been more people at Donald Trump's inauguration than at any presidential inauguration, you know, ever. And it was just like quite evidently not true, you know, from the photographs and a number of other ways that people have to measure crowds. And that was when she coined this term and brought this idea into the lexicon of alternative facts and said, you know, we're presenting alternative facts. So I just, my reaction inside of myself was just, what are we going to do about this? And my feeling was like, in order to sort of stand up for something, we need to be clear on what we're standing up for. There was a morning on the Marketplace Morning Report where we had, there would be like three news spots and a newscast. And two of them already were about Donald Trump doing something kind of outrageous. And then Donald Trump did a third kind of outrageous thing. And so I pitched a third news spot that was like, here's the other thing that just happened with the president. It relates to our beat of the economy. And the editorial decision at that time was like, we need to balance like two crazy Trump stories with like something else that makes him look kind of good. So that there's balance. And that's not hard hitting journalism, right? That's not real balance. That's just being afraid of being criticized. So, you know, I was at Marketplace doing daily news stories. So like every morning was, you know, Trump tweets and getting used to this new kind of reality. And I have this daily practice of writing and, you know, journaling and writing other things other than my journalism that I do. And I found kind of without even being conscious of it that I was writing about objectivity. I dashed off a bunch of thoughts about journalism and objectivity. You know, I like typed it up on my laptop in a Word doc and I put it up on my Medium blog because I'm feeling so much kind of urgency about this stuff. I want to see what other people think. There was nothing missable about Donald Trump's rise to power from the perspective of Central Ohio. But the national media isn't in Central Ohio. I think there's also nothing missable about the rise of white supremacist movements in conjunction with that. A lot of people in the Midwest or the South, especially people of color, could have told you that there was a rising tide of white supremacy coming for our national politics. But people in the newsroom I was in New York were like really surprised by all of that racist stuff that suddenly started emerging. So like our supposed neutrality and our supposed objectivity sometimes is actually just like lacking perspective. There's lots of journalism just throughout history that hasn't been neutral, right? And that hasn't been quote unquote objective, but that has revealed or exposed really important truths. I think of examples like Ida B. Wells, who reported as an activist and an advocate on lynchings in the United States. And she was the first person to really do investigative journalism that exposed the extent of lynching and the extent to which lynching was based on false accusations. And it was Ida B. Wells who exposed that. And she was always considered an activist and an advocate. But the fact that she wasn't neutral didn't mean that the work she was putting out wasn't true. I think we need to debunk the idea that neutrality has ever been real. You know, it's not helping us anymore. And once we can let go of that and sort of say, yeah, of course, we're all coming from a perspective, you know, then like fake news, you know, liberal media, it's biased, all that stuff, it doesn't hurt us anymore. You know, it's not a legitimate critique anymore if we're not even claiming to be neutral. All journalistic work is biased in some way. But what we're doing cares about the truth and about facts and about evidence. What if we claimed our subjectivity and just kind of said, yeah, sure, right, a lot of things are a matter of perspective. And we come from this particular perspective. And from this perspective, we're trying to seek out the facts with evidence to the best of our ability. I think that's what most journalists in public radio are doing, you know? So why can't we just kind of admit it?
Lewis Wallace's interview comes to us from Stephanie Lepp at the Reckonings podcast. To hear more of their work, go to www.reckonings.show. You're listening to Making Contact. To hear past shows, visit radioproject.org. Subscribe to our podcast or get our updates at radioproject.org.
So the original post on Medium is called "Objectivity is Dead and I'm Okay with It." And at the end of the post, I say, you know, I'm generally curious what people think about these ideas and would love to hear your thoughts. And I just kind of put the finishing touches on this piece in a Google Doc and, you know, copied it onto Medium, found some clip art, and hit publish. A couple hours after I posted it, I heard from my editor, my boss at work, and she said, I need to jump on the phone with you. The people in LA are upset, and LA is where the headquarters of Marketplace is. So I was sitting in my bed by myself on the cell phone, and I get on the call, and it's my editor, and then it's the managing editor of Marketplace and the executive producer and a person from HR sitting in on the call. And they sounded like they were reading from a script and basically said, your Medium post came to our attention and it violates Marketplace's policies in a number of ways. Marketplace reporters are supposed to be impartial and not share our political views publicly. And then they said, we're going to have to ask you not to come in to work tomorrow. And we're going to have to ask you to take the post down. By the time they were done, I remember my hand holding the phone was like shaking because I was so taken aback. And for all that I'm rebellious in this and that and the other, I take a lot of pride in my work and I don't like getting in trouble. You know what I mean? I don't like getting it wrong. This is not an easy decision. Like, you know, they want me to take the blog post down, but do I feel right about that? I called some people for advice. One of them was my dad, who's a lawyer. And he was like, take it down. Take the blog post down. It strengthens your negotiating position going forward. This is like something like that, you know? And so I said, okay, my dad is probably right. I should take it down and just do what they ask and then kind of go from there. So within 24 hours, I took the blog post down off of Medium. And so it disappeared. It left these like empty links. And then I kind of waited. And then nothing happened. And I woke up the next day. It was a Friday by then. Still not going into work. It's 10 days after Donald Trump was inaugurated, 11, 12 days now. I knew that I was going to be faced with moral and ethical dilemmas working in the national media with him as a president, but I didn't know it was going to be so soon and over something so seemingly small. At some point that Friday afternoon, I was at home and I was talking on the phone, this time with my mom. And I remember saying to her, I was like, I think I need to put this post back up. I think that's what I need to do. I feel like I'm disappearing. Like I feel like me, Lewis, the whole Lewis isn't here anymore. And we got off the phone and I just burst into tears, just like sobbing. And so I put the blog post back up and I spent a long time writing and editing a letter to the managing editor and executive producer who had put me on this leave and told me to take it down, explaining why I didn't feel comfortable with that.
Lewis expected Marketplace to call and ask him to make some edits to the piece. You know, change the title or make some cuts here and there. But that is not what happened. What happened was, he was told not to come into work again on Monday morning, and instead to go to a cafe to meet the boss from LA.
So Monday morning rolls around, and instead of going to work, I go to this cafe to meet the boss, who's apparently flown in from LA, like, just to meet me. And I walked in, and it was Deb Clark, who was the vice president, you know, the executive in charge of Marketplace, and a representative from HR. And Deb Clark just briefly talked me through what she felt I had done that violated Marketplace's policies. And then she said, "It just seems to me like you want to do a different kind of journalism than what it is that we do here. And so we can no longer continue to employ you." Before I started doing journalism, I was hyper aware of the power dynamics between journalists and kind of marginalized and underrepresented people, in part because that was such a strong, pronounced dynamic in coverage of trans people. But then it's really easy to get caught up in the day-to-day of doing journalism, like the tendency to kind of call people up and just like grab a quote and then go off and do your story and never talk to that person again. You know, the tendency to kind of be extractive in your approach to stories is like very much exacerbated by working in national media, because there's less accountability. There's actually quite a bit of accountability in some ways for local reporters. They might have to face the people face to face that they write about. As I became a national reporter, I had kind of fallen into a pattern of making excuses for not really being in that kind of accountable relationship with an audience, or especially with the most vulnerable people that I might interview or talk to. You know, Eddie Cave in Detroit. Objectivity and neutrality in some ways can be sort of a framework that excuses us from talking about accountability. You know, we're not accountable to anyone in particular, we're just neutral. But there was some kind of bug in my ear that was saying, "I don't know, man." Like, I don't know if what you're doing is really ethical. Being a trans person, coming out as queer really young, I've just always related to reality as something that I'm both participating in and responsible for changing, right? And some people would say, "Well, that means you shouldn't be a journalist," you know, because you're a person who wants to change reality, not just tell it. But I absolutely don't buy the argument that narrative and truth-telling is separate from the shaping of the world. There's just no way that I could separate the work of journalism from the work of, you know, either transforming or upholding the status quo. I was feeling just this complete mix of emotions. It was a huge relief when I came to this kind of moral clarity for myself of like, I'm not going to take this blog post down. And I felt really relieved when I got to that place. And then I put the severance agreement in the recycling because I wasn't going to agree to a non-disclosure or to not tell this story.
Within journalism, word travels fast. 2 hours after Lewis was fired, he got a call from a reporter. And from there, his story snowballed. He was interviewed by the Washington Post and the Daily Beast and on the media and even a major news outlet in Japan. His original Medium post was translated into multiple languages, and the post ultimately went viral, reaching hundreds of thousands of people. Lewis also had tons of people reach out to him personally, mostly to say, I'm sorry about what happened. And many to say, I'm a journalist too, and I feel exactly the same way, torn between my values and my job.
A month or two after my firing, I started working on a book, a history of objectivity in U.S. news media. And one of the sources who I interviewed, also a radio producer, said this thing to me that I keep thinking about, which is, her name is Ramona Martinez, and she said, objectivity is the ideology of the status quo. What you call objectivity is actually just white, male, cisgender subjectivity. You know, it's just the status quo. There is no neutrality. For a very limited and very privileged group of people, it might have felt like there was this one sort of way of narrating the world that the news media was succeeding at, and that it was just factual and it was just true. But for the rest of us, it was never really that way in the first place, right? So I do think it's important to let go of this idea that objectivity is dying. I think maybe a more useful framework is that objectivity is a mythology that we're now urgently debunking in order to figure out what can stand in its place. It doesn't lessen our commitment to pursuing truth or facts. It just reveals the complexity that was always there about the pursuit of truth and facts, which is that subjectivity informs that pursuit. Whenever I hear people talk about going back or sort of protecting some set of values that was presumably stronger in the 50s and 60s and maybe 1970s, I feel skeptical, right? Because there were like no black people in newsrooms and hardly any women and no transgender people, and you couldn't be gay. I mean, you could be fired just for being gay, right? So I wouldn't care to go back particularly. There's no back for me in my body and existence in the world today. I need us to be in this transformed and transforming world that we're in. And I do think that like working to transform something is an incredibly hopeful act, and giving up on it is a cynical act. And so to me, calling for journalism to transform its relationship to objectivity and to transform its relationship to diversity and representation is absolutely about investing in the importance of journalism.
And we're also not giving up on journalism. In fact, by airing Lewis's talk, we want to foster dialogue with our listeners and sit with uncomfortable, challenging ideas. That's part of why we create the show every week. And we know this is a big issue, objectivity in journalism, so we invite you to share your thoughts. Comment on radioproject.org or via social media and SoundCloud. You've been listening to Lewis Wallace, brought to us by Stephanie Lepp and the Reckonings podcast. We've posted some related articles, and we link to Reckonings and to Lewis Wallace at our website, radioproject.org. The Making Contact team includes Monica Lopez, Anita Johnson, Sabine Blazin, Dylan Hoyer, Lisa Rudman, and I'm your host this week, Salima Hamarani. And you've been listening to Making Contact.